1 Samuel 9 through 10. The sixth talk in a series on 1 Samuel was presented by David Crabtree on December 10, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're looking at 1 Samuel chapters 9 and 10 today. We're entering into a section that I think is particularly difficult, and I found it rather disturbing as I was thinking about it over the week. At the end, I'll explain why I found it so disturbing and see if I can help us think through how to what's going on here and why. Last week, Israel had asked for a king in order to help them in their conflict with the surrounding peoples, the Philistines in particular. Samuel said, no. Samuel said, that's a bad thing that you're asking. And God agreed it was a bad thing that they were asking for, that it was a rejection of God himself when they asked for a king. But nevertheless, God said, told Samuel, I'll have you appoint a king. Give them what they want. Samuel warned them of the consequences. But nevertheless, the Israelites persisted in their desire to have a king. So now in chapters 9 and 10, they're going to get their king. And this describes how that happens. Chapter 9, let's see, first section, 1 through 14, long section. Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechoreth, the son of Aphiah, the son of a Benjamite, a mighty man of valor. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome man. And there was not a more handsome person than he among the sons of Israel. From his shoulders and up, he was taller than any of the people. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. So Kish said to his son Saul, take now with you one of the servants, and arise, go search for the donkeys. And he passed through the hill country of Ephraim, and passed through the land of Shalishah. But they did not find them. Then they passed through the land of Shalim, but they were not there. Then he passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they did not find them. When they came to the land of Zuph, Saul said to his servant who was with him, come, let us return, lest my father cease to be concerned about the donkeys and become anxious for us. And he said to him, behold now, there is a man of God in this city, and the man is held in honor. All that he says surely comes true. Now let us go there. Perhaps he can tell us about our journey on which we have set out. Then Saul said to his servant, but behold, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread is gone from our sack, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have? And the servant answered Saul again and said, behold, I have in my hand a fourth of a shekel of silver. I will give it to the man of God, and he will tell us our way. Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he used to say, come and let us go to the seer. For he who is called a prophet now was formerly called a seer. Then Saul said to his servant, well said, come, let us go. So they went to the city where the man of God was. As they went up the slope to the city, they found young women going out to draw water and said to them, is the seer here? And they answered them and said, he is. See, he is ahead of you. Hurry now, for he has come into the city today. For the people have a sacrifice on the high place today. As soon as you enter the city, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now, therefore, go up, for you will find him at once. So they went up to the city. As they came into the city, behold, Samuel was coming out toward them to go up to the high place. There's no indication how long has passed since the Israelites had asked for a king and the events of chapter 9. It could have been quite some time, or it might be soon thereafter. But we're told the story of Saul, who went out looking for the donkeys that were lost from his father. Now, Saul is the son of Kish, and it sketches out his lineage, but he's a Benjamite. And his father Kish is a mighty man of valor. And that's probably better translated, a man of influence. Kish is apparently a prominent man in his community, both with wealth and prestige. So Saul comes from a well-known family, a well-respected family. And it points out in verse 2 that it says in my translation, a choice, but it probably just means young, in the height of his vigor. We find out later, if you do the calculations, he's about 40 years old. That's encouraging, I think. I remember when I was in, I went on an exchange program to Russia when I was in college, and we were in Kiev, and we were promised a meeting with the local youth, and we went to this club, and about half of the people there were between 35 and 40, and they explained that that's youth in Russia. So it must be the same sense of the term here in Israel. So he's young, he's handsome, and he's tall, which is obviously a virtue. So we've been given these are the physical characteristics and the social status that Saul enjoys, and those are all the appropriate things for a king. That's what you would expect. That's what you expect from a king. You expect someone who is stands out in many respects, and can lead you in battle, is a lot of what they would have been thinking at the time. So strong and big. These donkeys have been lost, and Saul is sent out with a servant to go and find these donkeys. And they carry out an extensive search. They're going all over the area that's controlled by the tribe of Benjamin. And they don't find them. They've looked everywhere. So it reaches the point where Saul's ready to give up, and he's afraid that his father is going to become more concerned about the well-being of Saul and the servant than of the donkeys, that it's reached that point where it's probably going to be worrisome to his father. So he's ready to go back and informs his servant. His servant is more persistent. His servant wants to try something else. It's not clear how his servant knows this, but his servant is aware that Samuel is in the area, and that Samuel is a prophet. Samuel is a seer. So it's the servant's suggestion that they go and inquire of the seer as to where the donkeys are. And that's a suggestion that has some promise as far as Saul is concerned. But as Saul points out, apparently it's the custom when you go to talk to the seer that you give him a gift. And they have nothing to give for a gift. So to the servant's suggestion, Saul sees a problem. But the servant has a solution to that, and that is he has some money, and he offers that as a gift that they could give to the seer. So then the problems have been removed, and Saul says, let's go do it. So it's interesting here. We get a little snapshot of what kind of person Saul is. He may be tall, he may be young, he may be handsome, he may be well-born, but it's his servant that shows the creativity and the initiative in a situation where they're trying to solve a problem. And Saul, his response to it is to find problems with it initially, and then when that problem is solved, then he's fine with it. So they go to the city, and as they're approaching the city, there's some young women coming out to get water. They meet these women, and the women inform them that they're very fortunate in that a sacrifice and a feast are about to be held, at which Samuel will be doing the sacrifice, so he has to be there, and Samuel will be making his way towards the place of the sacrifice at this very moment. And that would be a good chance to catch him and be able to speak to him briefly. So they tell Saul and the servant, go quickly. This is your opportunity. Take advantage of it. Catch him before he goes to the sacrifice. The next section, 15 through 21. Now, a day before Saul's coming, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel, saying, about this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be prince over my people, Israel. And he shall deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have regarded my people because their cry has come to me. When Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, behold, the man of whom I spoke to you, this one shall rule over my people. Then Saul approached Samuel in the gate and said, please tell me where the seer's house is. And Samuel answered Saul and said, I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today. And in the morning I will let you go and will tell you all that is on your mind. And as for your donkeys, which were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them, for they have been found. And for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for all your father's household? And Saul answered and said, am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak to me in this way? So the day before this event, that is the event of the sacrifice and the time when Saul is coming to this town, God had revealed to Samuel that he would meet on the next day the one who would be the king over Israel. So Samuel's expecting Saul to come. He wouldn't know who Saul is. He just knows that this someone is coming who Samuel is supposed to anoint. Then, when Samuel sees Saul, God speaks to Samuel and says, behold, the man of whom I spoke to you, this one shall rule over my people. God is being very active in the selection of this person who will be the king of Israel. So when Saul comes, Samuel knows who this is and knows what he's supposed to do. Samuel invites Saul to join them at the sacrifice and then to spend the night with him. And Samuel is going to talk to him, and he says, and will tell you all that is on your mind, and then says, and as for your donkeys, which were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them. So all that's on Saul's mind is not the donkeys, it's something else. And I would guess that it's what Saul's wondering is, what's going on here? Why was I expected? Why am I being invited to this honored this honored position at the feast, etc. So I suspect it's those kinds of questions that Saul has. And Samuel says, I will answer all those, and don't worry about your donkeys. And apparently, and then he goes on to say, and for whom is all that is desirable for Israel? Is it not for you and for your father's household? For whom is all that is desirable in Israel? I'm not sure exactly what this means, but apparently it's Israel will be yours. That is, everything that's desirable in Israel will be yours, in a sense, and for your father's household. In any case, Saul understands it is to be a momentous kind of thing that Samuel is claiming. And Saul's response is a very modest response. He says, am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak to me in this way? Whatever Samuel is communicating to Saul, Saul understands that it's momentous, and Saul's response is, I'm not worthy. This is a very modest response. But it becomes clearer later what it is that Samuel is offering. See, next section, through the end of the chapter. Then Samuel took Saul and his servant and brought them into the hall and gave them a place at the head of those who were invited, who were about 30 men. And Samuel said to the cook, bring the portion that I gave you, concerning which I said to you, set it aside. Then the cook took up the leg with what was on it and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, here is what has been reserved. Set it before you and eat, because it has been kept for you until the appointed time. Since I said I have invited the people, so Saul ate with Samuel that day. When they came down from the high place into the city, Samuel spoke with Saul on the roof. And they arose early, and it came about at daybreak that Samuel called to Saul on the roof, saying, get up, that I may send you away. So Saul arose, and both he and Samuel went out into the street. As they were going down to the edge of the city, Samuel said to Saul, say to the servant that he might go ahead of us and pass on, but you remain standing now, that I may proclaim the word of God to you. So Samuel brings Saul to this feast, and he says to the cook, bring out the leg which I had you set aside. So Samuel has, based on what God had told him, and the warning that God had given Samuel that this person that he is to anoint would be coming, he has already told the cook, set aside the leg. And the leg is the privileged piece. That's the piece of honor. And that's the one that will go to Saul. And he has invited Saul to join them, and there are only 30 men that were invited to come, and Saul is added to that select group of people. So this is a high privilege that's been given to Saul. So he eats and feasts there with the 30 men at that sacrifice, and then afterwards they go to the place where Samuel is staying, and Samuel and Saul have a long conversation. It's on the roof. The roof, obviously, they live in a drier climate than do we. And the roof becomes an extra living room for the houses in that part of the world. So that's where you go to get cool in the evening. And so they're up on the roof. They're just talking to one another. And I'm sure Saul has a lot of questions, and Samuel is filling him in, presumably, on what the elders' request of God was, the request for a king, and what God's response was, and what Samuel said to the elders, and the fact that the elders still wanted a king, and all that God had told Samuel with respect to Saul coming. All of that must have been the topic of conversation. It's unfortunate that isn't all recorded here. Then Saul goes to sleep, apparently, on the roof. And in the morning, Samuel gets him up and sends him on his way. But as they're leaving, Saul escorts him out. And, I mean, Samuel escorts Saul out. And Samuel says to Saul, "Send your servant on ahead, because I would like to speak privately with you." And he says that I may proclaim the word of God to you. Chapter 10, first 8 verses. Then Samuel took the flask of oil, poured it on his head, kissed him, and said, "Has not the Lord anointed you a ruler over his inheritance? When you go from me today, then you will find two men close to Rachel's tomb in the territory of Benjamin at Zelzah. And they will say to you, 'The donkeys which you went to look for have been found. Now behold, your father has ceased to be concerned about the donkeys and is anxious for you, saying, "What shall I do about my son?" Then you will go on further from there, and you will come as far as the oak of Tabor. And there three men going up to God at Bethel will meet you, one carrying three kids, another carrying three loaves of bread, and another carrying a jug of wine. And they will greet you and give you two loaves of bread, which you will accept from their hand. Afterward, you will come to the hill of God, where the Philistine garrison is. And it shall be, as soon as you have come there to the city, that you will meet a group of prophets coming down from the high place with harp, tambourine, flute, and lyre before them, and they will be prophesying. Then the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you mightily, and you shall prophesy with them and be changed into another man. And it shall be, when these signs come to you, do for yourself what the occasion requires, for God is with you. And you shall go down before me to Gilgal. And behold, I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You shall wait 7 days until I come to you and show you what you should do." So Samuel in private, so the only ones that are there are Samuel and Saul. And in private, he anoints Saul. This is the first indication, first mention of any anointing of anyone other than a priest. Priests were anointed. There was provision for priests to be anointed in the Mosaic covenant. But this is the first time that anyone but a priest has been anointed. So this is interesting. This is significant. Samuel anoints Saul and says, "Has not the Lord anointed you a ruler over his inheritance?" And this is a question that is phrased in such a way that it demands a yes response. He's not asking a rhetorical. I mean, he's asking a rhetorical question. Then, after having anointed him, he tells Saul that there are three signs that are going to happen. Three signs that indicate that this is not just something that Saul has dreamed up. This is something that God has orchestrated. The first one is that he will meet two men at Rachel's tomb. And they will say that the donkeys have been found. So that's the first incident. The second incident, they will run into three men who are on their way to Bethel. And one of them will be carrying three young goats. One will be carrying three loaves of bread, and the other will be carrying a jug of wine. These would all be appropriate offerings. So apparently these three men are headed to Bethel, which is one of the places where offerings were given. They're headed to Bethel to present offerings to God. And they, when these men meet Saul, Samuel says, they will give you two loaves. So they will give of their offering to Saul. So that's the second sign. Then the third is, in each one of them, it tells Saul where they're going to happen. not only what's going to happen, but the location of each event. And the third one, as they're, going up the hill of God, that there will be a group of prophets coming down from the high place with harp, tambourine, flute, and lyre before them. And they will be prophesying. Now, I don't know how to picture this. I don't know what it means to run into a group of people with all these musical instruments coming down the hill prophesying. And as I rummage through my reference books, there's lots of speculation as to what this might have been like. But from what I can tell, it's just speculation, that nobody really knows what this would have looked like and what it would mean that they were prophesying. But presumably this is something that Saul would have recognized, and it serves as the third sign. And in conjunction with this third sign, it says that the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you mightily, and you shall prophesy with them and be changed into another man. That seems very, that's significant language. The Spirit's going to come upon Saul, and he'll be changed into another man, and he will prophesy. And Samuel says that all of these things are going to happen so that, as a sign that, he says, and it shall be when these signs come to you, do for yourself what the occasion requires, for God is with you. Then he gives instructions to Saul that are going to become significant later on. In a couple of chapters, this is going to become very significant. He instructs Saul that he is to go down to Gilgal. It doesn't say when, but at some point in time, he's to go down to Gilgal. And that Samuel is going to follow and will meet him there in order to offer burnt offerings and to sacrifice peace offerings. And that Saul is supposed to wait there 7 days until Samuel comes and shows him what to do. I won't comment on that further now, but that's going to become very significant in about 3 chapters. Next section. Then it happened, when he turned his back to leave Samuel, God changed his heart, and all those signs came about on that day. When they came to the hill there, behold, a group of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God came upon him mightily. So he prophesied among them. And it came about when all who knew him previously saw that he prophesied now with the prophets, that the people said to one another, "What has happened to the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" And a man there answered and said, "Now who is their father?" Therefore it became a proverb, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" When he had finished prophesying, he came to the high place. Now Saul's uncle said to him and his servant, "Where did you go?" And he said, "To look for the donkeys." When we saw that they could not be found, we went to Samuel. And Saul's uncle said, "Please tell me what Samuel said to you." So Saul said to his uncle, "He told us plainly that the donkeys had been found." But he did not tell them about the matter of the kingdom, which Samuel had mentioned. So, exactly what had happened, what had been prophesied, what had been predicted by Samuel, it happened. The three signs that Samuel had mentioned, they all came about. And it says that God changed his heart. That also seems momentous. And when he encountered the group of prophets, just as Samuel had predicted, he prophesied with them. And the people that are standing around, apparently there are some who know Saul. He must be close enough to his home that there are people here that recognize him. And they say, "What has happened to the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" So presumably this is a kind of behavior, a change, that is not expected on the basis of Saul's past behavior. I'm not sure exactly what that means, other than it did not appear that Saul would have been prophet material. And a man there answered and said, "Now who is their father?" And I can't remember what that... Oh, yes. That it's possible that people came to assume that the gift of prophecy was passed down, as we saw with Samuel, his sons, Eli, his sons. So it's possible that they came to the assumption that that sort of thing tends to be passed down. And that could be then why there's a man there who says, now who is their father? In any case, and it says, therefore it became a proverb, is Saul also among the prophets? In context, then, that would appear to mean you would use this kind of saying in those situations where someone makes a major turn late, kind of in the middle of their life, one that you wouldn't expect. That Saul has made a turn here that no one would have anticipated. Now he's prophesying among the prophets, acting like a different kind of person. Then Saul returns home, and his uncle asks him about what all happened, and Saul tells him how he found the donkeys, that he went to Samuel, and Saul's uncle, having heard that he went to Samuel, wants to know, what did Samuel say? And Saul plays it very close to the vest, doesn't give much information. All he says is that Samuel told them plainly where the donkeys could be found. Obviously, he's omitting a little bit. So once again, and it's not clear why, but he's very modest with respect to this. He's certainly not bragging. And the last section of chapter 10. Thereafter, Samuel called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah. And he said to the sons of Israel, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I brought Israel up from Egypt, and I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the power of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you. But you today rejected your God, who delivers you from all your calamities and your distresses. Yet you have said, 'No, but set a king over us.' Now, therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans." Thus Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. Then he brought the tribe of Benjamin near by its families, and the Matrite family was taken, and Saul, the son of Kish, was taken. But when they looked for him, he could not be found. Therefore they inquired further of the Lord, "Has the man come here yet?" So the Lord said, "Behold, he is hiding himself by the baggage." So they ran and took him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? Surely there is no one like him among all the people." So all the people shouted and said, "Long live the king." Then Samuel told the people the ordinances of the kingdom, and wrote them in the book and placed it before the Lord. And Samuel sent all the people away, each one to his house. And Saul also went to his house at Gibeah. And the valiant men whose hearts God had touched went with him. But certain worthless men said, "How can this one deliver us?" And they despised him and did not bring him any present, but he kept silent. So now we don't know how long has passed since the events of earlier in chapters 9 and 10, and this now in the latter part of chapter 10. But here, this is a public situation in which Saul is selected as king by God. In this instance, Samuel has called all of the heads of Israel together. So there's a big assembly of representatives of all the tribes here. And Samuel chooses by lots. So So I don't know how they did it then, but it's the equivalent of taking all the names of all the tribes and putting them in a hat and picking one out at random. Then all of the clans of that tribe, their names would all go in the hat and the clan be selected at random. And then the names of all the families from that clan would be thrown in a hat and the family selected, and then you get down to the individual. So this is all done at random, and as you progress through this, it's narrowing down to Saul. So earlier, God had picked Saul by speaking to Samuel and orchestrating events such that Saul came to Samuel. Now, but then it was private. Only Samuel and Saul knew what was happening. But this is public. And once again, God is selecting Saul. When Saul's name is drawn out of the hat, everybody looks around, well, where is he? And he's nowhere to be found. So they ask God, where is he? Where is this man? And God says, he's hiding in the baggage. Saul's a little strange. He's very, I'm not sure whether it's just modesty or exactly what it is. But he's way over in the baggage. He's brought out, he's taller than everybody else. He looks kingly, and the people all shout, long live the king. So, having been recognized as king then, Samuel writes out the ordinances of the kingdom. So their constitution, presumably. This is how things will happen here. He wrote them in a book, and that book is placed before the Lord, and presumably that means in the temple. Then everybody goes home. Saul goes to his home at Gibeah. But notice the ominous note in verse 27. But certain worthless men said, how can this one deliver us? And they despised him and did not bring him any present. It's ominous in that Saul's authority is already somewhat eroded. The people of Israel wanted a king. They're given a king, but immediately there are people who are dissatisfied. This is not what we want. But Saul's response is interesting. He's aware of this resistance to him being king, but it says, but he kept silent. So rather than responding and with force, he decides, let's wait. I will be vindicated, and the choice of me as king will be vindicated over time. Okay. Now I have to try to explain why this was so disturbing to me. This is just the beginning of a section about Saul. The section on Saul goes to the end of 1 Samuel, so we'll be looking at several incidents in the life of Saul. It's interesting, however, that we don't have all that much information about Saul. We don't really trace his life through. Most of the time is devoted to his selection here and then his conflict with David. And there's very little else. And as we see, as we go through 1 Samuel, David is slowly going to rise to the fore, even in 1 Samuel, and then he dominates 2 Samuel. So David gets a lot more press than does Saul. Saul's is relatively little. But in what we do read about Saul, his career is a very troubled one. At the beginning here, we see him being selected and singled out with what appears to be a lot of favor from God. God went out of his way to single out and indicate that Saul was unquestionably the one that God was picking to be the king of Israel. He informed Samuel in advance. He had Samuel anoint him. He gives signs to Saul that all of this is God's orchestrated event. He gives Saul the ability to prophesy. Then he goes through this public process of selecting him by lots. So confirming all of this in public before all of Israel. Furthermore, some of the language that I pointed out earlier is quite strong. It says Samuel told Saul that those signs were an indication that he was to do what was appropriate at the time because God is with you. It says in Samuel 10:9 that God changed his heart. In 10:10, the Spirit of God came upon him mightily. All of that sounds like God is closely identified with Saul and working through Saul. Yet at the end of Saul's life, and actually it's even before the end of his life, in Samuel 15, verse 11, God comes to the place where he says, "I regret that I have made Saul king." And then as we go progress in 1 Samuel, it appears as though Saul goes crazy. Saul loses his mind largely in jealousy over David. Furthermore, as we progress through here, God's grievances against Saul, the reasons that he gives for rejecting Saul, appear to be rather minor. They're ticky-tacky things. And it looks like God is just looking for excuses to ding Saul. And when you contrast that with David, who committed truly horrible things, David commits adultery. David commits murder. And yet, God forgives those of David. So when you weigh them, when you're looking at what did Saul do and get condemned for, and what did David do, and yet those are forgiven, and he's called a man after God's own heart, what's going on here? Is God capricious? Is he fickle? Does he bless someone? Does he identify closely with someone? Is he with someone at one time and then later not? And I think that the thing that I found so troubling about that is reflecting on my own life. And what does that mean? What is God's commitment to me? And how do we think about that? So I spent the week thinking about that. And I think that I have to admit, I feel somewhat sympathetic with Saul as I read Saul's story. I find myself empathizing with him rather than seeing him as a bad guy. So that's part of my thinking. I think that the resolution is that a distinction needs to be made between one's role in history and one's eternal destiny. People get all kinds of roles in history. One can get a positive and prominent role in history. One can make the history books. One can be president and free slaves and that kind of thing. Or one can get a role in history as a scoundrel. Someone who has done horrible things. Or one can have a role in history that goes unnoticed completely. Or one can have a role in history where it starts out good and turns bad. Or a role in history in which it starts out bad and turns good. Or starts out good, turns bad, turns good. I mean, there are all kinds of permutations of what our role in history can be. If you think about let me just single out a few roles in history. Cyrus, the king of the Medes and the Persians, who allowed the Jews to go back to Jerusalem That's a significant role in history to play. But what's interesting and important to note is one's role in history is not the same as one's eternal destiny. Those are very different things. I don't know where Cyrus will be in eternity. I don't know whether he'll be in heaven or in hell, even though he played a glorious role in history. You could think of someone like the robber on the cross, whose role in history was a bad one, insofar as he was a robber and was put to death and crucified. But he will be in heaven. His destiny, his eternal destiny, is to be in heaven. I think of someone like, and I'm not sure this name is correct, but the mass murderer, is it Jeffrey Dahmer? Is that the right name? And I don't know what his situation is. I just know that isn't it James Dobson who had a series of interviews? Did I get it wrong? Oh, Ted Bundy. Okay, change it. Ted Bundy. That James Dobson had a series, but he was also a mass murderer, right? I get them all mixed up, all those mass murderers. James Dobson had a series of interviews with him, and my understanding is that Dobson came to the conclusion that Ted Bundy really did come to a place of repentance. And if that's true, his eternal destiny will be in heaven. And yet his role in history is incredibly bad. So there's a huge distinction between one's role in history and one's eternal destiny. I find myself, I have over the last few months found myself frequently thinking about George Bush in this respect. And this is not, I'm not making a political statement here. But just as a human being thinking about another human being and thinking about all of the responsibility that he has and what has happened as a result of some of his choices with respect to Iraq and the mess that has been created by that, and how a human being thinks about and deals with all of that responsibility and what history will say about you. I mean, Bush is in an incredibly difficult situation, regardless of what you think about his choices or what you think about him as a man. That's just an incredibly difficult situation. But there's this other side of it, and that is, how does Bush, as a man, deal with his role in history? How does he think about it? How does he respond to it? Because that's ultimately the question. That's the important question. And that's the question for all of us, is how do we deal with the role that God has given us through all of its vicissitudes, through all its ups and downs, whether it's good or whether it's bad? How do we relate to that? And how do we think about the God who would put us in that situation? And that's really the important personal question. And I don't know what God is doing in the heart of President Bush, but I hope that it's coming to repentance. And I don't know what's going to happen historically. It may end up even a worse mess, but that's a separate issue from what is happening in the heart of President Bush. This is all, I think, part of what Kierkegaard calls the offense of the gospel. That it is the nature of the gospel, it is the nature of the way that God has set things up to deal with man and man's rebelliousness, that it's offensive to us. And there are elements about it there are several elements about it that are offensive to us. And one of those things is that God, in his transcendence, would put us in difficult and even miserable circumstances, that God would dictate those circumstances to us in his transcendence, and that he would be the kind of God that would have mercy on whom he will have mercy. And is that okay with me? Could I live in that kind of a universe? Could I live with that kind of a God? And it's not easy. It's not easy to accept that we would be mere creatures in a universe that's created by a transcendent God who is going to have mercy on whom he's going to have mercy. But if we can come to terms with that and allow God to be God, then we can only be thankful if God chooses us, because we realize the extent to which it is not because of us, it's because of God that that's possible. And furthermore, not only is God transcendent, but God is stable and trustworthy. If he has chosen me, then he can be trusted to stick with his commitment to me to the very end. He will not go back on that commitment. He has promised, and we will not go back on his promises, that if he has begun to work in our lives, he will bring that to completion and perfection. Life may get tough. Our role in history may be a difficult one. But God will be working through the circumstances of that role in history to bring about his purposes in our lives and to shape our soul and to make it perfect, to make it what it ought to be. So that's the perspective that I'm taking with respect to Saul in this book as we proceed through it. And we'll have to see if this picture matches what we read in there. And if it doesn't, then I'll have to amend my perspective. But the way I'm seeing it right now is Saul was given a difficult role in history. Saul was selected as that person who would be the king that should have been the kind of king that the Israelites were begging for, were insisting on. And what would come of that? Saul would not be able to come through. He would not be able to bring the kind of security that the Israelites wanted. What they wanted was not the solution. And Saul's going to be the person in history that, one of the persons in history, that will demonstrate that that's the case. And as a result, he has to start out fully a king. And fully a king means to have God's stamp of approval. He has to have all the physical prerequisites. He has to be born of the right family, and he has to have God's stamp of approval. God picked him out and gave him the authority that the people of Israel wanted given to a king. And in spite of that, he could not solve the problems of Israel and could not bring the security that they wanted. Instead, what's going to happen is God's going to bring along another king, one that's selected on different criteria, on different timing by God, and that's going to be David, who is going to be a contrast to Saul. David is going to be the kind of king that can be used as a tool of God to bring about security, at least a measure of security. And then David then becomes a paradigm or a model for a king that can bring real security that will be later to come. So that's the way I'm putting it together so far, and we'll be looking at the details as we progress through 1 Samuel to see if that works. Okay, questions, comments?
Having watched the Israelites behave in the desert and their career with the authority of God, I could imagine why when Saul being elected king, he would hide in the baggage train, because it's not like a job that anyone would want.
Yeah, that's true.
The two questions I was looking at is, first of all, there seems to be a compare contrast with the the natural attributes of Saul to the natural attributes of David. David seems to be unimpressive and very young when he's chosen, and Saul seems to be everything the Israelites would want. Could you kind of talk about that a little first?
Yeah. I think God has a pattern of taking that which by human standards would appear to be inadequate and using that as a demonstration of God's adequacy. And that's, we see that pattern repeated time after time. Moses can't talk. Israel isn't a nation. And yet God says, I'll make that my people, my nation. Christ himself doesn't look like a Messiah. But there are a lot of examples in the Bible of people that don't look like they're the right stuff. And yet God picks them out and in his own very creative way uses them as a demonstration of his strength, because it couldn't have happened without God's activity making that person adequate. And I think that's part of what's going on here.
Would you say it's like, I mean, Israel asks for a king, and so he gives them exactly what they were, I mean, just as kingly a king as they could ask for.
Right.
And he turns out to be a kind of a jerk.
A failure.
A failure, at least. So then, leading into my second question, if we were to look at the discrepancies in First Samuel, Second Samuel, between the way David's life is dealt with and Samuel's or Saul's life is dealt with, could there not just be a more academic like explanation, like regime change, like the people who are writing the book, history books?
Oh, sure.
I mean.
Sure.
That Saul just kind of gets swept under the rug because we all know David's the for sure. Like the SH.
Sure. Sure. It's that could easily be done. In fact, it occurred to me when I was reading it. It has been my observation that after a time of trouble, it's best to be the second ruler. Because the first ruler runs into these high expectations that could never be met. So you need someone to fail before the expectations can be lowered such that someone can actually meet them. So there's a sense in which this is exactly what you would expect. But obviously there's something more going on, I think, than just fitting that pattern. That David is a different kind of person. And David is not incompetent, but his competence came in an unusual form. And I think that's generally the pattern that one sees, is that the people that God uses frequently are just other educated. They're just other developed than what you would expect. But they have their own competence, and it's competence that God has built into them. It's just that it's not readily apparent. It's not standard.
I guess then this being my third question, what do we do with those passages in the Old Testament that look like, they look fantastic in a sense? Headlong hair, got it cut, forget his name.
Samson.
Like, Samson's that classic Jewish superhero. Like, what do we do when he's killing hundreds and thousands of Philistines with jawbones and things like that? I mean, like, what do we do with these things that look like just a human hand writing a history and telling a story, and Saul gets kind of swept on the rug? Because let's face it, he was, you know, nobody really liked him anyway. And like, I mean, what do we do with these moments in the Old Testament where it just looks less divine and more like some guy writing a history of the Jewish people thing?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, that's part of what was disturbing to me in looking at Saul over the week is how do you account for these bad good guys like Samson? I mean, is he a good guy or isn't he not a good guy? And how do you think about that? And that's tough. That's tough. But I think ultimately, that distinction between one's historic role and the eternal destiny is an important one. Because whether one is a good guy or a bad guy is ultimately dependent on that decision that one makes that determines one's eternal destiny, not on their historical role. And I don't know where you put Samuel or Samson with respect to that.
But also with regard to the fictitiousness. I mean,
oh, that it just sounds fantastic.
Yeah, Saul, I mean, you described that, you know, God, Saul seems to do knick-knackety little things that he gets in trouble for, and David goes out and kills, murder, and does everything. So, like, I mean, when we look at the Bible and we say it's true, and yet we see Samson doing crazy things, and this thing that looks like a human hand fictionalizing history, what do we do with that?
I see what you're saying. I'm going to save that till another time, I think. Just one more question. I think we're going to have to go.
It kind of came to mind to me when we went over and said something about the sons of Belial didn't like the decision. And then talking about Bush and then looking at Saul, his modesty and hesitancy. It made me think that maybe part of the biggest distinction between like Saul and David may be their willingness to accept the role. And it also made me think like our decision when we look at somebody who has this particular type of leadership, I mean, what right do we have sometimes to criticize, or what role do we have to criticize, and so on. And that's and then also we're, you know, human, we do make stupid mistakes and so on. But I think one of the main reasons God would say that David was a man after his own heart, because David was willing to take the role, whereas I don't think Samuel was.
Saul?
I mean, I'm sorry.
I get him mixed up too.
That Saul wasn't willing to take the role. That I'm beginning to look and see more and more that his modesty was more of like, I don't want to do this.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, I think you're right that accepting our role is a significant part of that process of coming to terms with who God is. And accepting our role doesn't mean that we don't try to change things. We can try to change things, but recognizing that if we can't change things, then that's the role that's been given to me. And coming to terms with that, accepting that, and God's right to put us in that predicament. Okay, thanks.